Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and we're here with another of our virtual events. And today we have our good friend Brian Freeman with us, and he's going to be talking about his brand new Bourne novel, Jason Bourne novel, The Bourne Treachery, which is what a great color scheme. Really like
that. Fantastic. Yeah. Love that cover.
And Brian was kind enough to sign a whole bunch of them for us. And so I will go ahead and put a link to our web store in the comments field, should you like to purchase one. And also, if you have any questions for Brian, go ahead and put them in that comments field, and I will be monitoring that. And I'll return towards the end of the hour when I'm summoned by Barbara. We have a little routine going. I go into the darkness for a while. And let me turn it over to Barbara.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Actually, one of the great reasons to buy an autographed copy of this book is that it's Brian's essay into the Bourne. I hope I have that right. Isn't this your first?
It is not. This is actually the second Jason Bourne novel.
This is the second? We talked about it last year, right? Goes to show my memory is failing. Oh, well. Anyway, I think he's doing a terrific job. And in fact, right before we started this, Brian was telling me that he is going to have 4 books launching next year in 2022. So clearly he's been working while staying at home. So tell us what it is that you're planning to publish next year, and then we will sally forth and talk about your second book in the Bourne universe.
I'm almost feeling a little guilty now that with the Bourne Treachery coming out, that's my last book launch for the year. But I'll make up for that in 2022. It's going to be a really exciting year next year. February 1st, the print and ebook editions of The Ursulina come out. And The Ursulina is my follow-up book to The Deep, Deep Snow, which was a New York Times bestseller and an Edgar Award finalist. And thank you. And, you know, and the funny thing is, as much as I love The Deep, Deep Snow, I think I actually love The Ursulina even just a little bit more. There is something very, very special about that book to me. So I can't wait to put it in your hands. I can't wait to hear what you think about it. It's a very emotional book, and it's a follow-up to The Deep, Deep Snow, but it's sort of a prequel and a follow-up together. I won't say more than that, but it all kind of comes together based on what happened in the first
book. Wait, explain the title.
The Ursulina, the Ursulina, for those of you that read The Deep, Deep Snow, is this mythical beast that stalks the forests of Middle County and Black Wolf County. And The Ursulina, the book, is about a sheriff's deputy named Rebecca Calder, and she is dealing with a killer who has sort of assumed the identity of this mythical beast. And so people are dying at the hands of the Ursulina, and written on the wall at these killings is the phrase, "I am the Ursulina." So that's the essence of the mystery. And it becomes entangled in Rebecca's personal life and forces her to just an excruciating decision at the end of the book. So it's a very emotional story. I just listened to the audiobook version of it, and I was just in tears at the end. So I figure if I can feel that strongly about the characters, I hope readers will too. So I can't wait for it to be in their hands on February 1st. So that's the first book in 2022. And then Jason Bourne will be back again next summer. That'll be my third Bourne book. The Bourne Sacrifice will be coming out. I don't have an exact date yet, but I'm assuming it will be in July. And then 2 more books later in the year, probably right around September, October. I've got a standalone novel that I'm actually working on right now called Girl of My Dreams. It's another very out there, very interesting thriller. Very excited about this book. And then for all of the Jonathan Stride fans out there, I certainly have not forgotten about Stride. Stride, Serena, and Maggie will be back in late October of next year in The Zero Night. And I turned that in a few weeks ago to my editor at Blackstone, and she wrote back and says, "This is fantastic. It's just stunning." So that's going to be coming out the fourth launch in 2022. So it'll be a busy year.
It will be for both of us, as it all turns out. I love that. We got to know each other over the Stride novels. It seems to me that those were the ones that you published early on.
Yes.
Because, you know, I don't know. When did you publish the first one? Haven't we been doing this for like 25 years?
Well, not quite that long, but it's getting up there. The first Stride novel came out in 2005. So it's been, what, 16 years of Jonathan Stride. So, it's been a long time. And I've really enjoyed these last several years having the opportunity to kind of go in some new directions and do some standalone novels and try some new series books as well. But, you know, I never want to forget about Stride. You know, he's where everything started and he's kind of an old friend to me. So I always like to go back and check in on Stride and see what's happening.
Up there in frigid Minnesota, not so frigid apparently at the moment.
Not these days. Yeah. We could use a little bit more of the sub-zero stuff here. So.
Right. Well, there you are. So Brian's books have been sold in 46 countries and published in 22 languages and have been nominated in their thriller awards involved. There's an Edgar Award involved. So he's got a wonderful track record. Tell me about the Byrne Estate, because, you know, it's interesting that there are several franchises going for authors no longer with us. You know, there's the Byrne universe, there's the Cussler universe now, there's the Parker universe.
Yep, Tom Clancy, yep.
Sam. Yeah, and the Clancyverse and so forth. And why is it you think that readers are still so attracted to these, you know, these worlds that other authors have built and want authors like you to continue them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think if anything, these legacy works are becoming increasingly popular, and you're seeing you're seeing some of the other, you know, well-known authors kind of going down this road. I remember, you know, in the old days, I was a little unsure about this. In fact, I can remember, you know, in the very early days of Jonathan Stride, I was joking with one of the St. Martin's reps, because there had been a new Robert Ludlum book out there. And I said, well, boy, you know, it's one thing to be competing with the living authors, but now I'm competing with the dead authors as well. I think there is such a strong, identity, which is sort of ironic when you're talking about Jason Bourne, but readers really identify with these characters and they love the idea of them continuing forward, even when the author, you know, isn't around to be able to carry on that legacy him or herself. And the key for me, I think, is can you bless you, and can you do the books in such a way that it really, you know, honors what the original author started. I mean, that's what it's all about. And what I am trying to do is, with my Jason Bourne books, is write books that, you know, that have the sort of the Freeman style and approach, and yet, you know, a reader can pick it up and feel like they're opening up a Robert Ludlum novel, and feeling like that if Robert Ludlum were alive today, this is the kind of book that he would be writing for these characters. So that's kind of my goal in bringing Bourne back, is to really be true to the character that Ludlum created. And I mean, it's an amazing thing that, you know, here we are more than 40 years after the Bourne Identity first came out, and you know, Jason Bourne is still, you know, an active, exciting hero that people look forward to, you know, seeing his next adventure. And it's, for me, it's a lot of fun, because I first read the Bourne Identity when I was, you know, 18 years old, all the way back in 1980. So the idea that here, all these years later, you know, I've got my name and Robert Ludlum's name on the cover of the book, that's pretty darn exciting.
Well, I mean, certainly we have to accept the idea that Jason Bourne is ageless, unlike the authors. And the other part too, because I mean, I've talked about this with Ace Atkins and Mike Lupica, who are now doing the Parker books, and, you know, just, I mean, since Clive died last year, we've done, I think, 3-4 books with authors who were writing with him while he was alive, rather than, you know, starting up once he died. And so I think it's a real challenge to bring the characters forward into the modern world without losing the character. I mean, if we remember, you know, Spencer was a Korean War veteran, and, you know, he's still going strong in Boston. There have been some changes, but clearly, you know, we've had to accept the idea that, you know, he can possibly still be alive and be a Korean War veteran. And I think that's a really interesting balance, you know, to try to stay in that universe, true to that character, but yet make it a contemporary story so that it doesn't become historical fiction, which would be your other opportunity.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And that was what I talked about with Tom Colgan at Putnam when I agreed to take on, you know, the Bourne series, and I was writing the Bourne Evolution last year, that I wanted to bring Bourne forward and really reboot the entire series and make it, you know, make a book that people that didn't even know Bourne or hadn't read any of the earlier novels, either by Ludlum or by Eric von Lispotter, could still dive in and get to know Jason Bourne, and at the same time be very true to the emotional core of who Jason Bourne was as a hero, and really capture the essence that's made him such an enduring figure in thriller fiction. But, you know, I looked at it and said, you know, there's no way I can take a hero whose roots are in, you know, Vietnam and have him sort of be relevant in a 2020 setting. I really needed to just capture, you know, the characteristics of Bourne and bring that forward then in an all new approach to the story.
You've also got a film legacy, a movie legacy, you know, of Bourne, which yes. I think for many people, you know, oftentimes we realize when talking to people, this comes up all the time with The Maltese Falcon, how few people have actually read the book, but how many people have seen the movie.
Right.
So, you know, their experience of The Maltese Falcon is basically the Humphrey Bogart, you know, kind of story, probably also true of The Big Sleep. And, you know, lots of classics. So you do have to, you've got a group of readers, but you've also got a group of people who watched, you know, Matt Damon running around.
And
somehow you have to synthesize all that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, there have been a lot of iterations of Bourne over the years. You know, it started with Ludlum, but then you also had, you know, Eric's books and all the Matt Damon movies. And right. and I'm one of those few Bourne fanatics that even realizes that back in the late 1980s, Jason Bourne was not Matt Damon, but Richard Chamberlain in a miniseries with Jacqueline Smith of The Bourne Identity. So yeah, there have been a lot of different, you know, takes on Bourne over the years, and that was kind of the challenge of how do you synthesize all these different ideas that people have of who Bourne is. And you know, the Matt Damon movies, I mean, they're great movies. Yeah. I don't think they're particularly close to Ludlum's vision of Bourne as a hero. I mean, I think he's much more of a loner in the movies than he really is in the books. He's more of sort of this laconic, you know, a superhero in some ways. And that's really not the picture, I think, that Ludlum created. And I wanted to sort of have, if a reader was a fan of the movies, if they wanted to imagine, you know, sort of Matt Damon in this character's role, that they can do that I've given them enough to kind of put that actor in that role. And yet at the same time, I wanted to create a version of Jason Bourne that was really very true to what the original character was back in the Bourne Identity.
So would you say that Jason Bourne, quote, the man with no money and no past, does that, you know, I mean, maybe part of the reason this can all happen is he's something of a blank slate.
Yeah, that's right. It's, you know, losing your past in some ways is creatively the gift that keeps on giving. There's all sorts of interesting little things that you can do with that. And so I've kept obviously that hook of Bourne in my books, that, you know, he lost his memory, and I'm soft about it. It was a few years ago, but clearly it wasn't back in the 1970s. But at the same time, I'm able to sort of, you know, provide hints and lay the groundwork to be able to do more with Bourne's past and bring that into storylines, because Bourne doesn't necessarily remember it, but doesn't mean that there weren't all sorts of other things going on in his life that sort of give good creative fodder for thrillers.
So Nova's a really interesting character. Talk to us a bit about Nova, because she's a pivotal character in this book.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about Bourne that is really important for readers to remember is that Bourne is not a loner. I mean, he's not that isolated person that I think you see in the movies. When you look back at the Ludlum books, Bourne is, I mean, he has an emotional need to have someone in his life. And Marie, whom he marries in The Bourne Identity, and then who's also in the heart of Bourne Supremacy and Bourne Ultimatum. I mean, Bourne and Marie, that relationship is absolutely fundamental to what makes Bourne such an appealing hero. And it's so important to the plots of the book as well. So I wanted to be able to carry that forward in my books. So in The Bourne Evolution, Bourne develops a relationship with a Canadian journalist named Abby Laurent. And in fact, we'll be meeting Abby again in my third book, The Bourne Sacrifice. And then in The Bourne Treachery, you know, Nova and that relationship again is really central to you know the essence of who Bourne is. And so I don't want him to be seen as this isolated superhero. I mean, he actually needs a woman in his life, even though that makes both him and them more vulnerable as a result.
Well, it definitely makes them more vulnerable. And, you know, action heroes don't really become family men with, you know, it's a really interesting thing. We just talked to Brad Thorpe last week, and Brad in not Near Dark, but the book before it, there was a terrible thing that happened, and Scott Harvath lost his, you know, lost his wife. And now he's met somebody new. And, you know, part of me said to Brad, this is too soon. He hasn't had time to mourn the wife, you know, and it makes him look a little. But then I realized that if you're a person who is at risk all the time due to who you are and what you do, that you basically have to grab happiness whenever you can. And so maybe characters like that don't have the leisure, you know, to go through a more conventional kind of mourning episode or whatever. But at the same time, I now have to wonder if the Norwegian ninja is for the high jump, you know, because can Scott really become a family man and still be, you know, the super spy running around? I mean, I think it's a really tough thing to work out.
It is a tough balancing act because you really can't have a happily ever after for any of these characters because, you know, that's not the way, you know, thrillers work. And if you plan to continue the series, there's always going to be, you know, danger and vulnerability carrying forward. So yeah, it's a question of being able to sort of strike that emotional balance without really tying the hero down, because for the long haul, that's really not going to work.
Well, you know, and it's not just tying the hero down to a relationship, but thrillers move. Yeah. You know, thrillers, part of the reason we read them is we move across landscapes. You know, we're going off to dangerous and exotic and, you know, varied places and so forth. Their missions are never static. And so, you know, it's hard to just like leave somebody at home while you're off and then occasionally coming back, circling back. But, you know, now Brad Taylor, for example, has worked out a group thing where the women and the men, you know, go together. Same thing with James Rollins and, you know, those thrillers. So I guess you can, if you have a team, you know, then you can have emotional attachments for the characters, but because they're on missions together, they're moving together. And sure. Then that works out. Although, you know, having a conventional family with children is not necessarily going to be really, well, it's not going to be successful. So there are all kinds of ways to look at this, but I really liked what you did with Nova in this book. But what I really want to talk to you about is one of my favorite places, Tallinn, Estonia. I have some great Tallinn, Estonia stories because, you know, it's a wonderful place to visit. So why did you pick Tallinn to have, like, you know, the big opening of this particular book?
I'm feeling like I'm stalking you, because as I recall, you were a big fan of Quebec City as well, and that's where The Bourne Evolution starts out. So I started
now that it all comes back to me, right?
There you go. Yeah. So I started The Bourne Evolution in one of your favorite places, and now I start The Bourne Treachery in one of your other favorite places.
Would you like to hear my Tallinn, Estonia story? Because it's gonna be wonderful. The first time we went there, Tallinn, for those of you who don't know it, is one of those cities that was too poor to modernize. And so in the 20th and 21st century, it's become a tourist destination because it is still quaint. They have, you know, the old town, and it's largely intact. It's like Bruges in Belgium and, you know, various cities like that. So it's a kind of must-see destination if you are traveling around up in the Baltic.
Yeah.
So we arrived in Tallinn, Estonia, and we're greeted, you know, with the walled city and all the, you know, wonderful stuff, which I lust for. So, you know, I'm taking a, but I'm also always on the lookout for local delicacies. I mean, something about travel makes you hungry. So as we pass into the walled city, we pass by what looks like a bakery or a restaurant or something. In the window is this incredible cherry pastry. I mean, it's gorgeous. You know, it's lush and it's red and it's shiny. You know, I'm drooling. I want this pastry. And my husband, who's a somewhat impatient person, no, he says, you know, well, we're going to tour around and we'll circle back. So I've done this before with him. So I kind of give up on the cherry pastry, but nonetheless. So we have this wonderful time morning walking around Tallinn, and amazingly, just by chance, we do end up back at the place where the cherry pastry is. They have one left. So I go inside, all happiness, you know, with my, I don't even remember if it was euros, probably so long ago it was local money or whatever. And I buy my cherry pastry and they put it in a little brown bag and I'm so happy. And I walk outside and I take it out of the bag. And at that moment, my husband sees something and he goes, oh, look. And the cherry pastry is like the peanut butter sandwich. It crashes.
Oh, no.
Face down to the pavement. And I'm going, oh, shit. You know, I'm so pissed. And he says to me, well, let's go inside. He said, maybe there'll be something else there. And I'm going, there's nothing else there that's going to equal my cherry pastry. I'm so mad. So we go inside and they have, it looks like a sort of deli and bakery, but there's depth to this store. And over here, they have some perfectly astonishing ices at sorbets and other things that really wildly exotic flavors. And that looks pretty good. But we continue to go to the back. And lo and behold, and only my husband can do this because he's like a dowser for restaurants, we are in the only Michelin-starred restaurant in Tallinn, Estonia, where they have duck and cherries. So I missed my cherry pastry, but I ended up having this incredible duck and cherry lunch to the envy of everyone who knew me. That's why we're still married after three, because there's always that narrow escape, you know, from calamity to... Well, you've been married a long time, so you know how that works.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, I've never forgotten it because it was just so, you know, one of those amazing moments. So I have a real fondness for Tallinn, but poor Jason doesn't get an opportunity to really look at food.
No, things don't go too well for him in Estonia. Yeah. You know, I mean, I love being able to use places that I've been and to give some, you know, romantic color to the books. And I Marcia and I took a Baltic cruise for our 25th anniversary. And that was back in 2009. And Tallinn was one of the places that we visited. And in fact, I think in our lockbox, we still have some Estonian currency because we had to exchange some to get off the ship, and of course never used all of it. So there's some very old Estonian currency in our box. But so I decided to use the city as the place to begin the book. And one of the things about Bourne that is so fundamental to him as a character is that sense of not being able to trust anyone, because everyone that he's known in his life has ultimately betrayed him, particularly, you know, the government, but a lot of people in his life as well. And so I wanted to start this book with in two ways. One, to introduce Nova and really get a sense of what the relationship between Bourne and Nova is, and then to have Bourne on a mission that fails spectacularly, and a mission where he ultimately believes that there was there was betrayal at the highest levels, and the failure of that mission then ripples through the rest of the book and kind of shapes how Bourne sees everything else that's happening around him.
Well, one of the reasons I made that little speech about Tallinn is that, you know, people who go there, visitors on cruise ships and other things, are captivated by its quaintness. You know, it's small and it looks peaceful and, you know, non-threatening and whatever it all is. And so the contrast between Tallinn And what you do to, you know, what you do, what goes down in Talon is really remarkable. And if you don't know the city, you don't appreciate the wonderful contrast that and the ironies that,
yes. Well, and that, was
that
true.
Brian has introduced.
And that was true in Quebec City as well, that I take beautiful romantic places and shoot them up. So.
Well, but Rebecca, you know, Quebec City, let's be fair, has something of a bloody history. I mean, the Plains of Abraham are all spread out there, and that's where Wolf, you know, defeated the French general Montcalm and claimed, you know, that part of Canada for Britain and so forth. Right. So the Chateau Frontenac, in fact, looms over the Plains of Abraham. So there's a certain military, you know, aspect to all of that, where, and undoubtedly Talon has, you know, some military history in its background, because those little Baltic states, the three of them, have been pawns forever. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you go around the Baltic, in fact, as you have done, it's really dizzying, because, you know, you're in Sweden and their traditional enemy over here is what, Finland or whatever. You go to Finland and their traditional enemy is Sweden, but over here it's Russia. And, you know, as you circle around the past history and the alliances and loyalties and treacheries and so forth, the Baltic really revolve. I mean, Sweden was a superpower back in the, what is it, 16? I think it was the 16th century, maybe the 17th century.
Yeah, but, yeah. Well, and I
even forget that now.
Yeah, well, and I was even able to fold a little bit of Stockholm into the book as well, when Bourne goes and visits a contact in Stockholm, and the contact happens to work at the Vasa Museum, where the old Swedish warship is.
One of my totally favorite places.
It's wonderful, one of mine too, and I thought, well, this is clearly a place that Bourne has to visit. So.
Absolutely. I mean, for those of you who don't know it, the Vasa was a ship commissioned by the one of the major Swedish kings, and he brought in a Dutch designer. And so the ship was built, they called them castles of the sea. The ship is very, very tall and very, very narrow. And to keep it from tipping over, it takes a ton of ballast down in the lowest reaches of the ship, so that it can stay upright. But unfortunately, they miscalculated. So the ship, after massive funding and, you know, all the rest of it, is so proud in the shipyards, and they let it go. It doesn't go, what does it go? Like 200 yards or something out of the bay. And it sinks. You know, just goes right down, and eventually was brought up in the 20th century. In order to keep it going, it's like, what's the name of the Henry VIII ship? The Rose, I think it's the Rose something. Anyway, another oaken ship that was brought up from the sea after centuries. And in order to keep them going, they have to keep the wood wet all the time. Saturated, because otherwise, after all those years underwater, it will disintegrate. But the Vasa Museum is just a glorious look at that whole age of Dutch shipbuilding, because the Dutch were really the first major maritime nation after Spain and Portugal, really before England got going. There are periods, you know, Spain is the 14th century, and then, you know, and Portugal, and then we get Holland, and then we get, you know.
Of course, one has to feel they didn't get too many contracts after the Vasa.
No. And I'm trying to remember if the guy was on, if the designer, the shipbuilder, because they all drowned, was on the ship when it went down.
Yeah, I can't remember. That's right. Yeah.
I don't think he was. Yes, he was, and it forced his widow into bankruptcy. That's what happened, you know, because, I mean, it wasn't quite the same system we have today, where our of lawyers would descend and, you know, sue everybody for everything. But clearly it was the ruin of the shipbuilding business by the Dutchman. And also, oh, I'm so glad you like the Vasa. It's one of our very favorite
fantastic
places.
Yeah, that's, you know, I always look for these wonderful, you know, interesting, romantic, historical places. And then I look for all these terrible things that I can make happen there.
You can see why Brian and I have an affinity, right? I like to go visit them too and see what's going on. You know, it's interesting, Brian, in a time during the pandemic when, you know, basically we've been at home. I at least have a tendency, my husband and I both, to revisit. And, you know, in stories and in our minds and so forth, even in photos, all these wonderful places we have been, and recognize that many of them will never be the same.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So you're, you know, you're taking Bourne to some of these places is really wonderful for those people who've missing travel or perhaps will never actually get to Tallinn, Estonia, yes, or so forth. It's an opportunity to visit them. Do you think that's one of the reasons that people like thrillers so much is that it really is a travel opportunity?
I think so, because, you know, the sense of place is so important to thrillers. I mean, I know for my purposes, whether it's in, you know, my Bourne thrillers or any of my other books, I always want to give readers that you are there feel, that you've been dropped down into every scene and you can hear it and taste it and touch it and smell it and feel it happening all around you. And if you can capture that authenticity of the place and evoke the emotions that people feel by being there, then they can really feel as if they're sort of invisible observers in every scene and they're kind of watching it all take place in three dimensions.
So talk about Treadstone a little bit, especially for people who may not really have a background in, we can't assume everybody who watches or will listen to this has actually ever read a Jason Bourne book.
Yeah, no, that's right. And what's been really interesting over the past few years is the way that sort of the Ludlum universe has been expanding and little elements that that came up in Ludlum's book are starting to be kind of worked out then by other authors and expanded into new areas. So in the Bourne Identity, Bourne's employer, as it were, is this secret agency called Treadstone, and they're really essentially sending Bourne out on a mission to capture the assassin Carlos, and Treadstone, in typical Ludlum fashion, is filled with double cross and triple cross and a lot of betrayal, but there's a lot of meat and substance there, and so now my buddy Joshua Hood has been writing Treadstone novels for the past couple of years as well, and so his new one was the Treadstone Exile, which came out in February, I think it was.
Yeah, we talked to him back then.
Yeah,
the first one as well. Right, I mispronounced Treadstone because for some reason I thought it was Treadwell, which.
Oh yeah. there's a great opportunity to kind of build out this whole series then around the concept of the Treadstone universe, and then there's also Blackbriar, which doesn't actually show up that much in the Ludlum series, but it becomes a fundamental part of the movies, and now Simon Gervais is doing a Blackbriar novel, so we're kind of taking that initial Bourne and it's expanding into some new directions and giving thriller readers an expanded Ludlum universe, which I think is terrific.
So this makes me think of an interesting point. If you read a Private Eye novel, the Private Eye's legitimacy investigating something, going on his mission, usually comes from a client. Somebody hires him to go do something. If you're in a police procedural, then as Michael Connelly would say, Bosch needs to catch a case because, he's a cop. It can't always be a personal thing. So I'm wondering, thinking about various of the thriller universes that we've talked about, do they have to work for some kind of an agency in order to have any legitimacy? I mean, it's Sigma Force for Rollins, and I'm trying to remember Brad's, he's got most of them seem to work for some sort of government, but not really official, often a sort of a black ops or a shadowy right. government agency in order for them to have agency. Scott Harvath, for example, he too works for something like Treadstone.
Right.
Legitimacy, but is it also accountability?
Well, I think in a lot of cases, yes, but I think it becomes more complicated in the Bourne universe because right from the get-go in the Bourne Identity, Bourne has a very, complicated relationship with Treadstone because right. essentially, in the Bourne Identity with Bourne, losing his memory and not knowing who he is or how he came to that point, he doesn't he doesn't really know what his relationship to Treadstone is, and Treadstone thinks that Bourne has betrayed them and is and they're out looking to kill him. So all the way back in the beginning, Bourne has had a very fraught relationship with Treadstone and doesn't, you know, I think with good reason, doesn't trust the government agencies. So that creates kind of an extra complication for me when I'm thinking about plots, because I agree with you. In most cases, you need that organization to kind of give an aura of, you know, legitimacy to why is this individual out killing all these people and getting involved in these things. And yet in the case of Bourne, he kind of has an arm's length relationship with Treadstone. And so in the Bourne evolution, I have Bourne having left Treadstone and gone to work at another organization, and then ultimately is framed for murder, and once again Treadstone is you know mistakenly trying to kill him, and then in the Bourne treachery I've got Bourne essentially sort of working again for Treadstone because he doesn't kind of see where his alternatives would be, and yet it's clearly not a comfortable relationship, and he's clearly still not trusting the people around him. So so as I kind of go forward in the series, I'm you know kind of in with each plot weighing how close and how distant is Bourne from Treadstone, and how do I kind of find a reason for him to be doing what he's doing, even if he doesn't necessarily have a direct kind of relationship with this shadowy organization.
I wasn't thinking about, I mean, you're right, it's a bit different with Bourne and Treadstone, but thinking about it from a practical standpoint, one, where's the mission going to come from? I mean, right. Somebody, you can't just have an agent floating around. He could be Jack Reacher, who, doesn't accountable to anybody, but most of the time there has to be some mission that comes up.
Yes.
But also, people can't live on air. So if they are on a mission or just, whatever it is, somebody needs to be paying them. They need to have some sort of a paycheck, some way to survive. I've always thought that was an interesting feature of a lot of Golden Age mysteries and so forth, that oftentimes you wound up with clergymen of one sort or another, a rabbi or a priest or same thing, because these were people who were being paid for that particular job, but the job allowed them to accept,
right. Or there were
sort of a mission or salvation thing. So, we had Father Brown and we had Rabbi Small and,
Or they were independently wealthy like Lord Peter Wimsey, so they didn't need to worry about money.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you could have Mr. Campion or Lord Peter and that's a very British thing, where the aristocracy who weren't working and who had pots of money could, find the Nile or, do all kinds of things because salary living didn't come into it. But that's not going to be true for these guys. They're going to need, somebody is going to have to provide them with a living and with a mission. But also, I think, accountability is a big thing, I mean, you've got to like report back or, be held to some kind of a timetable or, whatever it might be. In the Clancyverse, you can really, especially the Jack Ryan Jr., you can really see that. And even in the couple of TV movies they've made of it, and if none of that applies, then these guys are basically just rogue.
Right. And then you risk losing the reader sympathy. I mean, there's still got to be a moral code surrounding everything. And, sometimes it's the heroes that really embody that moral code and the agency behind them is the one that's morally questionable.
So. Well, I mean, you could go all the way back to, Mallory and Le Mort d'Arthur, which was a discussion I once had with James Lee Burke about Dave Robichaux, which I thought was completely fascinating. But, even then, while you had the knights writing off, to slay the dragon or rescue the maiden or whatever, nevertheless their organization was the round table. They had to their moral code, they had a report sort of thing, and presumably King Arthur and whatever provided them was some kind of funds, or they had family money or whatever. But it's always been true that there was some backing organization for for these guys to ride forth and slay dragons.
Yes, sure. Now, the one thing that I think was true in Ludlum's era and which works well for Bourne coming back in the modern era is that so much of the milieu in which Ludlum was writing was based on the political environment of the time. And so, you know, Vietnam and Watergate the sort of distrust of government and the feeling that strings were being pulled behind the scenes, all of that played out in the conspiracy theories of Ludlum's books. And you look at where we are in 2021, and there are some really interesting parallels, I think, in terms of the social and political climate, which actually makes it kind of perfect for having Jason Bourne reemerge in this environment, because he's dealing with that same distrust of authority that was true in Ludlum's era.
Absolutely true. I was just reading about, all the disinformation about, the vaccine and people who, think it, it's really terrifying to think about all of the distrust and misinformation that's floating around out there. And I'm wondering how long it will take us to come back from the Trump presidency, back to something where there is more civility and more trust.
Yeah, let's hope. Let's hope. I think the interesting thing about conspiracy theories is it speaks to sort of a natural human tendency to want things to have structure rather than chaos. I mean, I remember back when they were talking about the Kennedy assassination and all the conspiracy theories that emerged around whether Oswald was the lone gunman, and that someone had been commenting that the idea of this lone gunman, this nothing of a person being able to take out someone as consequential as Kennedy, seemed like there was this imbalance, it seemed impossible that this nobody could manage to to remove a president of the United States, and people sort of instinctively looked for a way to bring those things into balance, and the conspiracy theory did that. It sort of made people feel like there was more weight behind what had really happened, as opposed to just this crazed nut. And I think that you kind of see that today as well, that the desire for to have conspiracy explanation things actually sort of provides an order that people can glom onto, as opposed to just thinking that things are sort of randomly chaotic.
Well, I find that particularly ironic, since it surrounds a person whose chaos is the only environment in which he can operate, and then people are trying to come up with conspiracy theories to to make some sense out of it, when in fact there is no sense that can be made out of it. But we won't go on there. Before we call Patrick up, I would like to say that I wish that we could talk about this book all the way through, because there's really a fabulous twist. Brian's is a great plotter. I've always really admired the way he structures books and his plots. And I wish we could discuss the wonderful twist that comes up in this book, but no, you need to read it. I'll tell you what, when we do the next Bourne next year, we will make it a requirement that if you watch it, prepare for spoilers that we're going to talk about what happens in this book, because it's just super.
Good.
I'm not often surprised, and I have to say, I really was surprised, Brian. You did a great job.
Thank you.
So let's call Patrick up from, we'll do our thing now. Come out of the blackness, Patrick, and let us know if we have questions. Isn't that great the way this works? It's so much fun.
Yeah,
it's like a trapdoor. Here he comes. The Great Oz. Maybe we're going to like you with the Great Oz.
I wouldn't go that far. Let's see here. A lot of people are just saying how much they like your work, Brian.
Thank you. That's great.
Someone, Cammie, says, I just finished the Ursulina and it was outstanding. I'm trying to get him question about the Audible versions. Are you pleased with the readers that you've had so far?
Oh, yeah. I have been really fortunate with all my audiobook editions to have just some amazing narrators. Joe Barrett did all of the Jonathan Stride novels and the Frost Easton novels, and Andrew Edom does my book Infinite, and he's amazing. And Scott Brick does the Bourne books, and in fact Scott not only did The Bourne Evolution and now The Bourne Treachery, but he did Bourne Identity as well. So I think it's just fantastic that you've got that same voice, you know, carrying all the way to Ludlum series. But you know, I am so impressed with January Lavoie. I mean, she is just an incredible narrator. She did The Deep, Deep Snow and my book Thief River Falls, and now has done the Ursulina as well. I literally just finished listening to her doing the Ursulina today while I was exercising. And it's a little hard being on the treadmill when you've got tears just streaming down your face at the end of the book. So yeah, you know, the narrators are so important to the enjoyment of an audiobook. And I just, as I said earlier, I love the Ursulina. I can't wait for the paperback edition to be in your hands and to have a chance to talk to readers about that, because this is right up there among all my among favorite of all my books.
Well, to that point, somebody who has the great name of Tater Tot Coleman, the great name, says, when will the print edition of the Ursulina be available?
Oh yes, February 1st. So it'll be a great way to brighten up the winter.
That's awesome. Let's see here. Who are some of your, you know, I'm sure you're drawing from all sorts of different influences to come up with your own take on this, you know, this classic character. Are there any influences thrown in that might surprise people?
Oh boy, that's a really good question. I mean, obviously Ludlum himself is clearly the biggest influence. Sure. On the books, because I the first thing I did in taking over the series was go back and read Ludlum's original trilogy and listen to some of my other favorites from him as well. In fact, I just finished rereading the Chancellor manuscript again, one of my all-time, you know, favorite thrillers. I'm trying to think if there were other, you know, natural influences. It's, for me, it was kind of a question of creating a blend of my style and Ludlum's style to create sort of a whole new thing at the end of the day, so that this book is not just a Ludlum book, not just a Brian Freeman book, but this kind of hybrid that hopefully combines the best of what we bring. You know, I my books, my non-Bourne novels are very, you know, they tend to be very intense, emotional, psychological thrillers. And Ludlum's books obviously are very, you know, adrenaline focused, very action driven. And so I've been trying to bring those two things together and create Bourne novels that are very intense, very exciting, lots of action, you know, making you turn the pages. And yet at the same time, also really dig into the psychological puzzle that is Jason Bourne and being able to bring out those elements of his past and his relationships that really drive who he is.
Is there a Bourne Bible out there, or are there constraints, things that you feel comfortable doing this but maybe not this, and how do you gauge that?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's really not. I mean, I think that I wouldn't want to go beyond the parameters of kind of the essential Bourne story. I mean, this is a man who, you know, who lost his memory in a mission and that, you know, obviously changed the nature of his life. So you can't really mess with that essence of who Bourne is. But beyond that, the Putnam and the Ludlum estate have been extremely gracious and supportive with what I've been trying to do with the series, and they have been backing me the whole way. I was very honored that when they saw Evolution and saw Treachery, they came back and they didn't want to change a single word in either book. So for me, that really is that's a great vote of confidence from those folks.
You know, I should interpolate here that Brian, one of the things that's so interesting about him is he's had so many different publishers and so many different editors. Good, you know, he's a varied body of work, but I've tracked him through American publishers for a while. He only had a British publisher, and right now he has at least two. Is it only two or four American publishers? And, you know, it's not easy for an author to be working with a diverse cast of, you know, editors and all the things that go with actually publishing a book, sales teams and all the rest of it.
They have very different marketing strategies.
Absolutely.
And priorities. Uh, yeah, it, it, it is kind of a wild ride sometimes. I work with Thomas and Mercer, I work with Blackstone, Putnam, and Audible on different projects. And for me, yeah, it's always a little bit of a challenge, dealing with different editorial styles and marketing approaches. And yet what I really enjoy is that I can tell such different stories with each publisher, and all of them have been really, really supportive of allowing me to kind of push the envelope with what I'm doing, whether it's bringing Jason Bourne back or whether it's the standalones that I've been doing with Thomas and Mercer, or, you know, Blackstone taking over the Stride novels and what I've done with the Deep, Deep Snow and the Ursulina, starting with Audible and then carrying over into Blackstone editions. That's been very energizing for me. I feel like for the past, 5 or 6 years, I've been able to go in so many really different, exciting directions. And, I put down one project and I turn around and pick up the next one, but it's such a whole new character and story that I just find it very energizing. And that's frankly the only way I've been able to kind of keep up the prolific pace that I've had is because the stories are so different. I think if I were doing nothing but writing, the same kind of book each time, it would be a lot harder to do multiple ones in a year. I like that diversity.
You are a very high energy person. I've always really admired the fact that Brian could possibly fuel a nuclear sub all by himself. Anything else, Patrick?
Yeah, I mean, we're talking a little bit about Audible and, writing for Audible first, then to go into print second. Has that kind of, I don't know if I have a real question formed, but writing for that medium, has that made you pay attention more to the way your sentences sound?
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And that carries over into all my other books as well. I mean, I think that starting with The Deep, Deep Snow, which was the first one that I wrote to begin as an audiobook before it came out in print, I was really writing the book out loud and editing the book out loud. And I really enjoyed sort of the freshness and the immediacy that brought to the prose, and it just sounded right in my head that way. And so I've taken that approach with all my other books as well, even if they're not designed to start out as an audio exclusive. All the other books go into audio as well, but it just I love the idea of hearing how the book sounds. And what's interesting is I never used to be able to listen to the audio editions of my own books. It would drive me crazy because I hear the prose in my head in a certain way, and listening to somebody else do it would just, I'd have to shut it off. But now that I'm kind of taking that audio approach to writing, I'm loving listening to my own audiobooks. So that's kind of fun. So.
Yeah, and you're probably able to identify a clunker of a sentence a lot faster now, right?
Well, I can, although I've been really pleased with The Deep, Deep Snow and The Ursulina, because I'm always afraid. I mean, if I pick up one of my older books, I'd immediately bring out the red pen and start editing. But I listened to those books and I thought, gosh, there's not much that I would change. They're just the way I wanted them. So
that's great. Cammie has a question. Any new Frost or Cab books in the near future?
Oh, sure, Cammy, you had to bring that up, didn't you? poor Frost at the end of The Crooked Street, I threw him quite the curveball. I have not forgotten about Frost, I promise. With all these projects on my slate, it's been a little bit difficult to get back to him, particularly taking over the Bourne series. That sort of took over that last slot of free writing time that I had. But I'm really hoping that sometime soon I can talk to the folks at Thomas and Mercer and see if I can go back to Frost, because I know I left him in some precarious straits, and we need to know what happens next.
Let's see. Mike asks, will you ever do a historical novel?
Oh, that's a good question. I have nothing planned right now, but will I do a historical novel? I would confidently say almost certainly. I haven't figured out where it's going to be or what it's going to be, but yeah, I'm a big lover of reading nonfiction and history, so I definitely feel the urge to do some kind of historical novel. I just haven't nailed down exactly the right time and the right kind of story to go along with it.
Right. It looks like that is just about it for now.
Wonderful. Those are some great questions.
Yeah, very good.
Absolutely. Right. So I have one final one, because we've talked about the fact that somebody else is writing the Treadstone, Joshua. Yeah. Are you and Joshua, you know, working together at all? Do you talk before, do you have to stay in sync, or are they so different you don't need to?
They're pretty different. Josh and I have become good friends, over the past couple of years because of, both working on Love and Series. So we're texting each other fairly regularly, and we do a bunch of events together and things. But the stories themselves, there's not a lot of overlap. Back when The Bourne Evolution came out, I reworked a few things in the draft of the manuscript to sort of make sure I didn't step on any Treadstone toes in what Josh was doing. And Tom Colgan, the Putnam editor, helped me with that as well. It's now gone off in directions such that really there's not a lot of potential conflict between what Josh has Adam Hayes doing and what I've got Bourne doing. The fun thing actually would be if down the road we try to, bring them a little bit closer together than they are now. And I could certainly see, us trying to do that. I think of some of the, the TV series where they have crossover episodes where, part one is in one series and then part two shows up in the other series. So who knows, maybe Josh and I will have some fun with that at some point.
I can certainly imagine that you would. Well, it's been, as always, a real treat to talk to you. And gosh, four times next year. Wow.
Absolutely.
I know.
Maybe one of these we can do in person next year too. So
we could do that. That'd be wonderful. You travel down here from Minnesota, where it'll be colder than possibly in Minnesota. Yeah. It's a weird climate thing that we are doing. In any case, thank you for joining us. There'll be a podcast available probably tomorrow. We have signed copies of the book, and look at this absolutely beautiful cover. And we're so grateful to Brian that he allows us to send him books and he signs them for you. And, it's wonderful. Yep. There we go.
That's one of my better efforts too. That good to pick that one. So,
so you have a very good signature, it actually looks like Brian Freeman as compared to some other signatures, which, are like that. In any case, the video will live on for a long time too. So if you're watching it and you think you know anybody who would enjoy listening to the podcast or watching the video, please share it with them. And Brian, thank you very much. Go off Zoom now for however many months you've gone. Yeah, we'll reconnect. What, February will be our first time?
Yep, that's right. Wonderful. Yeah, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Of course it is. It's always been a treat to talk to you. So, Patrick, thank you very much, as always. And good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.